This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Florida Senator Marco Rubio is not a climate change denier. During his run for the Republican presidential nomination, when asked about climate change, he acknowledges the issue. But that does not lead him to push for any specific government actions. Here's Senator Rubio back in June during a New Hampshire television station's conversation with the candidate program on WMUR.
I believe climate change exists because we can measure that. But the truth is, climate's always changing. It's always been changing, and it will continue to change. What percentage of it is due to human activity? I don't know the answer to, and scientists don't know the answer to the exact amount of it that's due to human activity.
This week, a group of 15 South Florida mayors from West Palm Beach south to Cutler Bay in Dade County signed a letter to Senator Rubio calling on him to, quote, acknowledge the reality and urgency of climate change, end quote. The mayors want Senator Rubio to address a federal plan regarding climate change and specifically the threat of rising seas to their South Florida communities. Two of those mayors are with us here on the telephone on the Florida Roundup, Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine and Fort Lauderdale Mayor Jack Seiler. Mayors, welcome back to the Florida Roundup to both of you.
Well, good morning to you.
Mayor Seiler, let's begin in Fort Lauderdale. Was this letter politically motivated at all?
No, not in any way, shape, or form. I think, as you know, I served in Tallahassee for 8 years, served in the House of Representatives with Senator Rubio, and I actually respect him and like him. He's been somebody that I've had a good relationship with. This is a policy-based letter. This is a letter that is addressing issues that are critical to the state of Florida, issues that are critical to South Florida, and in particular, critical to the city of Fort Lauderdale. And so from a policy standpoint, you know, without pointing fingers, without placing blame or getting into partisan politics, from a policy standpoint, we just believe we need to have a discussion about the impact of climate change and rising sea levels. And as Mayor Levine knows, and I'm dealing with, we see it here in Fort Lauderdale.
But you did point the finger specifically at Senator Rubio in this letter. Mayor Levine, why just send the letter to Senator Rubio? Why not include Senator Nelson? Why not include the South Florida delegation?
Well, I thank you and thanks, Tom. I think what Jack Seiler, Mayor Seiler, said is very, very clear. The ocean is not Republican, it's not Democrat. All it knows how to do is rise. And, of course, we have two senators in the state of Florida, and Senator Nelson has been a great champion. He's out there beating the drum, bringing greater awareness to sea level rise, was on the Senate floor talking about what's happening in South Florida. And, unfortunately, Senator Rubio is kind of MIA. A lot of people call him Marco Polo because we can't find him. He's wandering all over, but he doesn't want to pay attention to what's happening in his own hometown. So, truly, I have to tell you, I don't want to call it partisan, but I would say that we are pointing the finger myself, because I think that the senator is nowhere to be found on this issue.
He's not the only South Floridian running for president.
Right, but he's obviously the only South Floridian that has a national federal office elected, and his duty is to provide assistance and, of course, for his constituency. And when you only have two United States senators in the state of Florida, we're getting no federal assistance whatsoever. And one of them is MIA. I mean, it's a shame. So,
Mayor Seiler, why not include Governor Bush or even Donald Trump, other South Floridians? Donald Trump has oceanfront property in South Florida.
Yeah, but I don't listen. Donald Trump, to me, is not focused on any real policy issues right now. It seems to be more all about sound bites and partisan attacks. So having a discussion with Donald Trump about a policy issue, I think, may be a waste of time. As it relates to Governor Bush, again, serving 6 years with him in Tallahassee, we'll have that discussion. We'll certainly want to have that discussion. I think you have to keep in mind that Senator Nelson has been a leader, as Mayor Levine pointed out. He has held meetings. He has done things on the House, on the Senate floor. He met with me in his Washington, D.C. office on this issue. He has been a leader at the forefront of this issue. And what frustrated me more than anything in that debate last night was everybody seems to say, well, we're not going to do anything with respect to the environment if it has an economic issue or has an economic impact. I'm trying to explain to all of these gentlemen, all of these candidates, that, look, the environment is an economic issue. The rising sea levels is an economic issue. It is a billion-dollar-plus economic issue, and we can't say we're going to ignore environmental issues because we don't want to adversely impact the economy. Let me tell you something. The economy will be adversely impacted forever in South Florida if this environmental catastrophe continues.
You're referring to the 7th Republican presidential debate, which took place in Des Moines, Iowa, on Thursday. Of course, the Iowa caucuses are on Monday. Senator Rubio was asked about a cap-and-trade policy that was debated in the Florida House while he was House Majority Leader and the House Speaker. And then he went on to say that as president, he would not support any national cap-and-trade policy. This is the idea where you cap carbon emissions and then you can trade the allotment around. There's a value to being able to exceed those allotments. I want to go back to May, where Senator Rubio was on ABC's This Week Sunday program, and he was asked again about this idea of climate change and the causes of it.
I don't agree with the notion that some are putting out there, including scientists, that somehow there are actions we can take today that would actually have an impact on what's happening in our climate. Our climate is always changing. And what they have chosen to do is take a handful of decades of research and say that this is now evidence of a longer term trend that's directly and almost solely attributable to man-made activity.
Now, let me go back to the causes here, Mayor Levine, because your letter asks the senator, Senator Rubio, to acknowledge climate change. He has acknowledged that the climate is changing. Do you accept that?
Well, I think what it comes down to from the mayor of the city, and I believe that Mayor Sauer probably agree, is that, you know, we can have a debate about climate change from now until the end of time. The fact of the matter is the climate changing, the sea is rising, and what we really need is federal assistance to make our roads higher, to install pumps, to create a level of resiliency in our towns. And unfortunately, we can't even get the attention of one of our United States senators to literally come in and say, hey, you know, we have a problem in Fort Lauderdale and Miami Beach and some of these coastal towns, and we have to come up with ways to make them more resilient. I mean, clearly, you know, in our state, Tommy, we have a situation where, you know, we have a governor that's out there lowering taxes and claiming that's the best way to attract business. Well, you know, I got to tell you, unless you're trying to attract the scuba business, I mean, the fact of the matter is that you need to create resiliency. We do not want our cities underwater, and we need to be investing. And the only time we've seen Senator Rubio in Miami Beach, I think he did a fundraiser during Art Basel or something like that.
Now,
that was about it.
You talked about some of the municipal efforts. Pumping, of course, has been a big investment in your community in Miami Beach. Mayor Seiler in Fort Lauderdale, you've been raising roads, A1A, for instance. Your letter, though, goes on to say, quote, we need a realistic national plan to slow global warming emissions. The letter doesn't get into real specifics about municipal actions. You're calling for a national plan about global warming and emissions, such as what? What would you propose?
Well, let me say this. From a local standpoint, and I think Mayor Levine would agree, we've already done substantial work in terms of we have a sustainability advisory board. We have entered into numerous agreements with, you know, of different partners, both public and private, and addressing these issues. We think there needs to be a national discussion as to how we address this. I'm not going to sit here as the mayor of Fort Lauderdale and tell a member of the U.S. Senate that he needs to do a cap and trade versus a coal restriction versus a natural gas issue. That's not my role. My role is that the debate has to take place. And the debate has been taking place as far as it relates to Senator Nelson wanting to discuss these issues, talking about these issues. Both members of our Senate delegation need to say, look, Florida is a vulnerable state. Florida is a state that if the environmental issues continue, we are going to have a severe economic impact. And so I would hope that as the third largest state, our two senators would work together on solutions, would work together bringing the rest of the Senate around, bringing the rest of the federal government around and saying, look, the local governments have taken a leadership role. Mayor Levine's done remarkable things in Miami Beach. We're doing a lot of good work here in Fort Lauderdale. Others, the counties, even, you know, have been working together, but we need to get the national attention addressed to this, just as we do with catastrophes such as hurricanes, as we do with floods, as we do with tornadoes. There has to be a discussion that if these sea levels continue to rise, we are going to erode much of our economy here in South Florida, or we're going to have to shift so many things around, and it's important that this discussion take place. But I'm not here to say that this is specifically the policy they need to pursue or not pursue.
That economic argument is also used by Senator Rubio and others, again, back in May on ABC's This Week program. He had mentioned that some of the proposals that have been put forth about emissions and otherwise, in his estimation, Senator Rubio's estimation, would ruin the economy.
I do not believe that human activity is causing these dramatic changes to our climate the way these scientists are portraying it. That's what I do not, and I do not believe that the laws that they propose we pass will do anything about it, except it will destroy our economy.
That was Senator Rubio back in May on ABC's This Week program. Mayor Phil Levine of Miami Beach, your letter calls for policies that, quote, reduce global warming emissions at home. FPL, our electric generator here in South Florida, generates more than 85% of its power for South Florida, including Miami Beach and Fort Lauderdale, you folks know this, from fossil fuels. So, again, maybe Mayor Levine, if you'd like to propose something national, I mean, where does this national discussion that you are proposing for Senator Rubio begin when it comes to national policy and emissions?
Right. Tom, thank you. And I think that, you know, what Mayor Seiler is saying and what I'm saying is very similar. What we're saying is that we're not out here to tell the United States Senate specifically the type of policies. We know we need to reduce emissions from fossil fuels. Well, I think what we're saying is we need your attention. We need your help in these municipalities. You know, we have two senators, and like I said before, one shows up to work, one comes to Miami and Fort Lauderdale, one makes it a point to make sure that the understanding is there, that we're getting the attention, and the other senator, and that's the frustration, doesn't show up. And I think that that letter really is about, hey, we have two United States senators for a reason. The other one needs to show up. This is a big problem. We need your help. We need a national dialogue, but at the same time, we need federal assistance. We need federal funding. And it's very frustrating. I think that's what that letter is about. I think that we have 50% of the engines working. The other 50% is kind of not showing up for work. And it's a shame. And I think that's what you're seeing, the level of frustration.
Most of municipalities have nonpartisan elections. We should point out, as Mayor Seiler, you mentioned you served in the Florida legislature as a Democrat. Mayor Levine is a Democrat. And some Republican mayors also signed on to this letter that you signed on to as well. Why not also send this letter to the men who are running to replace Senator Rubio in the United States Senate? Senator Rubio has said he's not going to return. He's not running for re-election. So, you know, depends on what happens over the next few weeks. He may or may not continue to be on the national political stage.
Well, let me take that, because I was just with Pat Murphy, who is the congressman who is running to replace him, and he was in Fort Lauderdale specifically on this issue. We were talking about beach nourishment, re-nourishment, rising sea levels, climate change, sustainability, resiliency, all these issues. We were just talking to future Senator Murphy, I will say, but there has been a real...
We'll take that as an endorsement, Mr. Mayor, Democrat.
I will openly say I've endorsed him, but I will tell you what, he has been very, very visible and vocal on this issue. And let me just add one other thing, Tom, because I was in Tallahassee when Senator Rubio led that debate on the environmental issues. I was on the House floor during that debate, and at that time I was encouraged by the fact that we were having that discussion in Tallahassee. So, you know, last night he seemed to try to distance himself from that discussion, but I was proud to serve alongside him in Tallahassee when we were trying to address these issues. So I'm just asking for that same focus that he had in Tallahassee on this, and let's make sure we come together, we put aside the partisan politics, and we simply say, what's the best public policy for Floridians?
Put aside the politics, but why not also include, Mayor Levine, the Republicans running to replace Senator Rubio? A number of those Republicans are from the Gulf Coast, from the Tampa Bay area, and certainly they're dealing with the same kind of sea challenges that your community in Miami Beach is dealing with.
And that's a very good question. And I think what's interesting here is that, and Mayor Seiler said, and I'm going to say it, is that yes, we have various people running for Senate, and some of them clearly are taking this issue very seriously. But we have one of our native sons, who's a current United States senator, who's running for president of the United States, who's coming from Florida, who's basically ignoring climate change, ignoring sea level rise. And I think part of that letter message is, hey, Senator Rubio, you're out there on the national stage. You're doing these debates. We're having a problem down here. In the unlikely event that somehow you get some kind of nomination at the bottom of the top of the ticket, don't forget about us. Look what's going on. We need this to be at the top of everyone's mind. It's that important right now. So this letter is not just about being senator. This letter is about the future as well. So clearly he's running for president, and it's important for him to make sure that this is out there.
This letter asks for a meeting with Senator Rubio by February 29th. It is a leap year this year, so there's one extra day in February, of course. But this is the same day that early voting in the presidential primary in Florida begins in Miami-Dade County, 6 days before early voting begins in Broward. Mayor Seiler, do you anticipate to secure this meeting with the candidate?
I have not heard anything. Maybe Mayor Levine has, but no, I have not heard anything about getting together. I would listen. I'd welcome this meeting at any time while he's serving as our U.S. Senator. This is a critical issue for the state of Florida, and in particular for South Florida. You know, if he calls back and says he can meet first week of March, I'll make myself available. I'm sure Mayor Levine will make himself available. I'm sure a lot of these mayors, as you recognize, both Democrat and Republican, will make themselves available, whether it's by that deadline or not. We're certainly anxious to meet with them, discuss these issues, as we have with Senator Nelson.
Mayor Levine, you'll give the senator an extension maybe beyond the Florida primary, March 15th?
Listen, absolutely, but let me say one thing. It's very hard to reach Senator Rubio. And as you know, the nickname is Marco Polo, because you never know where he is. The staff doesn't know where he is. So if some way, somehow, someone can locate him, I would make sure that we'd be able to meet him 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, anytime, any place.
Well, I'll also mention,
I'm not very confident about that.
We reached out here at WLRN to Senator Rubio's office for a response to the letter, and as of Friday morning, had not received any official response. Your Honors, thank you for your time here on the Florida Roundup. We appreciate it greatly.
Well, thank you very much, and have a wonderful day.
You as well.
Thank
Mayor,
you, Tom.
Mayor Philip Levine there at the end from Miami Beach. Mayor Jack Seiler from Fort Lauderdale joining us here on the Florida Roundup. We got plenty more to come, including the Zika outbreak in South America and its potential to spread here to South Florida, plus Haiti's presidential crisis. It's all next on the Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Explosive. That's how the World Health Organization describes the spread of the Zika virus. The disease is carried by mosquitoes and is now in 20 countries, most of them in Central and South America. World Health Organization Director Margaret Chan said this on Thursday.
Last year, the virus was detected in the Americas, where it is now spreading explosively. As of today, cases have been reported in 23 countries and territories in the region. The level of alarm is extremely high.
The virus has been linked to microcephaly. This is a birth defect that causes abnormally small heads in babies. More than 4,000 pregnant women in Brazil are estimated to be infected with the virus. Here in the United States, the Centers for Disease Control has issued travel alerts for pregnant women in 24 countries spreading throughout the Western Hemisphere. Have you traveled to Brazil or another country battling the virus? Are you pregnant and have travel plans that'll take you to Central and South America? Maybe you have a family. Are you concerned about them? Are you a doctor or nurse here preparing? Are you preparing for the virus? Let us know. Joining the Roundup today at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Look for us on social media, on Twitter and on Facebook. We're at WLRN. Tim Padgett, America's editor here at WLRN. Sammy Mack covers health issues, and Jacqueline Charles covers the Caribbean for our partner, the Miami Herald. Let's begin here, Sammy. What do we know about this virus here in South Florida, whether or not it's here?
Well, we have not had any endemic cases. There are people who, of course, travel to these places and come back having gotten it elsewhere. We have not had any cases where somebody who hasn't traveled has gotten the virus. We do have the mosquitoes that can potentially carry the virus. And in fact, these mosquitoes live all the way up to Oklahoma. So that is something that folks are watching, and public health folks are kind of watching. And mosquito control is, I'm sure you're going to see, becoming another topic of conversation, just like it was when dengue showed up here.
Jacqueline, how big is the footprint of this virus? We heard the WHO director talk about 23 countries. Is it essentially throughout the entire hemisphere?
I think that it's getting there. If we look at chikungunya, which was the virus last year that came into our hemisphere, what I'm being told by the experts in the region is that we can expect that same pattern. And also, I can tell you, for example, in Haiti, it was just a little less than 2 weeks ago where health officials confirmed that they had Zika. But people were reporting Zika since December, but they were just dismissing it as rumors. So there's a question to be asked, a very valid question, in terms of other countries in our region and territories countries do they have Zika, but they just don't know because they haven't tested for it.
A lot of the attention, Tim, initially has been focused on Brazil with these abnormal birth defects that have been linked to Zika. But to the point of the footprint, we hear Jacqueline talk about the Haitian response. What have we heard from other Latin American countries, other Central American countries?
Well, sort of extreme in some cases. El Salvador, for example, is advising women in that country not to get pregnant for another 2 years. Colombia is advising women not to get pregnant for another 6 months or so. So you're seeing, as Margaret Chan said, we're seeing alarm across the continent.
Sammy, how contagious is this virus?
Well, we're still kind of figuring that out. The virus has been around since the 40s. It was first discovered in Uganda, and it has been sort of slowly traveling kind of in our direction. And this is a huge outbreak. There hasn't been anything seen like this before. And, you know, again, like we have the mosquitoes. Latin America has the mosquitoes. Central America has the mosquitoes in a way that that this is being transmitted at a really large level. And the other thing about it is only one in five people who get infected with the virus have symptoms. Mm. So there's also a lot of asymptomatic people who are potentially getting bitten by mosquitoes who then travel to other people. And that's kind of how it moves around.
But even though the outbreak is huge, admittedly huge, I don't think we would be seeing the alarm about this. This would be more on the level of a dengue or chikungunya response. What's causing the alarm, as you've pointed out, is the microcephaly link. And the big question is, since we haven't seen that link in Zika outbreaks in other parts of the world, including Africa and the South Pacific, why all of a sudden are we seeing this very pronounced link between Zika and this birth defect in babies in Brazil? I mean, you've got many cases right now of microcephaly there, particularly in rural areas, and they're trying to figure out what is it about Brazil that is causing this virus to suddenly leap into this manifestation of microcephaly.
So we've heard concerns voiced by public health officials here in the United States, by the CDC, talking about these travel alerts, Jacqueline. You've heard your experience in Haiti about the government kind of dismissing the initial discussion about it. What about an island like Haiti, a country island like Haiti, and the public health acceptance that Zika is here and its access to healthcare and its ability to treat this and get information out, let alone medicine and other kind of treatments?
Well, what's interesting in Haiti is that because so many people have had it, but we don't know what that number is, you go to a pharmacy and the pharmacist is saying to you, okay, here's what you need to do. Load up on vitamin C. You need to take a form of Tylenol, 500 milligrams, three times a day to deal with the pain. And then they start to tell you the symptoms to look for. Fever, which not everybody gets a fever. A rash, which is usually the first sign. Red eyes, it looks like conjunctivitis. You're very tired. And I was told that the last sign is basically like a very severe headache. But again, if one in five people don't have those symptoms, the way this virus is transmitted is that within the first 5 to 7 days that it's in your system, if you get bitten by a mosquito, it passes on to the other person, just like chikungunya.
And this is a really important point because it's flu-like symptoms, which is that phrase that you hear all the time. And for, a reasonably healthy person, up until what was happening in Brazil, there was kind of not the same alarm that you would see around something like dengue, which can become hemorrhagic and can be a killer. Even chikungunya can make you much sicker. There is no real treatment other than fluids and
rest.
Ibuprofen and rest for this one. There's no vaccine.
And no vaccine, right. And one of the big problems, one of the reasons you're seeing such a bad outbreak in Brazil, I just came from the University of Miami Life Science building, and doctors there are working with Brazilian health officials to try to develop not just a vaccine, but perhaps just as important, if not more important, a more reliable test. Because that's one of the reasons we've seen the outbreak so large in Brazil, is because it's hard for health officials now to discern in blood samples the Zika virus from other viruses like the dengue and the chikungunya. Now, if they can start getting a more reliable test, they can start getting out in front of this. The other problem, though, being in Brazil, is that you've got probably more problems with stagnant water and breeding grounds for mosquitoes than any other country in the hemisphere.
In such a stretch of real estate in order to cover.
Exactly.
Is this, because of that, is this, Tim and Sammy, is this something that we've seen initially in rural areas, but is it growing into the more of the population centers in Brazil and elsewhere?
Well, yeah. Sure. Travel patterns have a lot to do with it. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're, for example, the worst part in Brazil, the worst manifestation is up in the poor rural Northeast. The second worst problem in urban areas like Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo. So that's got health officials confused as well.
You mentioned some of the reaction from El Salvador, however unreasonable that may be to essentially say zero population growth for 2 years, essentially, coming from the government, or Colombia saying zero population growth for 6 months. What kind of policy impact does this have, does this virus potentially have in Latin America, especially as it comes to health policy?
Well, I think what you're going to see in the wake of this is a lot more serious approach in places like Brazil to cleaning up the breeding grounds. I mean, that's one of the reasons that we're not, you know, so scared about this right here in the United States. We do get out in front of public health situations like that. Brazil and other, you know, subtropical and tropical countries have got to start cleaning up the breeding grounds for these this kind of mosquito.
But it's coming at a time where the Brazilian economy is slowing down, in fact, going into a recession. It's coming at a time when the world attention toward Rio especially is going to increase as we're, you know, on the eve of the pickup in activity in terms of Carnival in the next really week. And then, of course, the Summer Games after that. I mean, there's a real global potential.
There's a huge economic impact. I mean, and in the Caribbean, they're panicking. I mean, they're not saying it publicly, but when they had chikungunya, you look at a country like Jamaica, and it really impacted the tourism. And so today, if you've got Zika and the CDC is telling people not to travel or to cautiously travel, if you're a Caribbean government and you depend on tourism, you're looking at the bottom line and saying, what is this going to do to my economy?
The WHO, Sammy, is holding a special meeting next week. What could be the outcome of that? Could they deem this as a global emergency, a pandemic in the making, something perhaps smaller? What do we anticipate? And what could be
I mean, outcome? I think what you'll hear is a lot of conversation around mosquito control for sure, because controlling the vector really in terms of public health is the way that you stop these things. I would imagine we'll hear some conversation potentially around the policies that kind of put the onus on women to not get pregnant, because, you know, there are all sorts of issues about resources and access there. And a lot of these places are not known for access to contraceptive care for women. And yet they are asking them to not get pregnant for a couple of years. So I think there will be a lot of conversation around that. There will probably be some requests for funding to get in front of this thing. And definitely you'll hear calls for more research into this, because there is so much that is not understood about at what point does a fetus get infected, or we don't even know if it's some other kind of reaction happening with an infected mother that may or may not pass to the baby. We really don't know. And until you know that, you can't stop it.
But here's the other big question for Brazil and other South American countries. How are they going to contain this before the Olympics? Yeah. Because I was just talking to a UM researcher who said one of the possible incubation periods for Zika coming into Brazil was the World Cup there 2 years ago, when people came in from Africa and the South Pacific possibly carrying this virus.
Yeah, this is a virus that dates back to the 1940s and has been traced to the continent of Africa. Tim Padgett covering Latin America for us here in Miami. Stick with us. Sammy Mack, we'll say goodbye to you, watching health policy for us here in South Florida. And Jacqueline Charles watching the Caribbean for our partner, the Miami Herald. Let's move on and focus in on Haiti with presidential politics. It's supposed to have a new president in a little more than a week, but before it decides who that will be, Haiti still needs to work out exactly how to elect that person. There were a couple of delays and a second round of elections that was supposed to happen this week instead was canceled a week ago today. There have now been marches in the streets. Some turned violent. Jackie, any clarity on the election schedule?
Well, I think before we can get to the election schedule, we have to address the question of who is going to govern this country come February 7th. That is the day that under the Haitian Constitution, a president is supposed to pass the power on to a new president. And because that issue is not settled, that's what's going on right now. You've got a couple of proposals that are out there, and basically the individuals of the president, the head of the Senate, as well as the Senate, and some members of the private sector, they're all trying to come up with some sort of consensus, and they're under a lot of international pressure to do so.
Let me bring in Carrie Kahn, NPR correspondent in Mexico City. Carrie, you were in Haiti earlier this week. What was the mood on the streets? And if there is this interim leadership, how could that be greeted by the Haitian public?
Oh, I think those are all very hard questions. It's the mood on the street is that people are very concerned. And there's just so much uncertainty. I talked to business owners, I'm profiling one in a story I'm doing today for All Things Considered, and he said his business has dropped since last August, when this election cycle just began to spin out of control, has dropped by 70 to 80%. He made it through the earthquake. He actually, his business did well during the earthquake, but he doesn't think he's going to make it through this electoral crisis. You know, the gourd is dropping. The economy is in turmoil. The drought has caused so much hardship, raised food prices. There's so much going on in Haiti, and it's just this political turmoil on top has just made this huge, huge tempest. It's very unclear what's going to happen right now. And there were comments by President Martelly yesterday where he suggested maybe he wouldn't leave power. So it's a wait-and-see situation that is making a very difficult situation in Haiti even worse.
Wait-and-see, Tim, but we don't have to wait that much longer to see what comes next, because February 7th is just around the corner, and that's the constitutional date where there's supposed to be a new president.
Right, and as Jaggery's pointing out, then what? There's talks about maybe setting up an interim government. Well, if you're watching this at all, how are you going to set up an interim government if you can't even elect the president in the first place? And I think the United States has got to, there's been this criticism of the United States because Washington and the Obama administration have been pushing so hard to just get an election done, because I think there's this mindset still in Washington that in a country like Haiti, a bad election is better than no election at all, because we tend to think in the United States that democracy in the developing world just means have a good election. We don't realize that democracy is what happens after elections, and that if you are so obsessed with having elections, then we've got to help countries like Haiti make them better.
And one of the reasons why Haiti's in the situation it is because of all the allegations of a bad election process, fraudulent election, and just a bad process that led to the situation that there's now. Let's go to the phones in Lauderhill. Samson joins us. Welcome to the program. Go ahead. Samson, are you with us? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm here. How are you guys? Thank you for having me.
What's your comment, sir?
Yes, I have two quick comments. First of all, I don't think Martelly is the man to them. Second of all, I do think we, like the Asian people, we're not like yet ready for a truly democracy.
All right, we'll take those points here, Samson. First one is President Martelly, the current president, Jacqueline, not the problem. The international community says what? Haitians say what?
Well, I mean, more and more I'm hearing people say, you know, on the streets they're saying that President Martelly cannot be part of the solution. But the reality is that he is the elected president of the country, and he is there until February 6th or 7th, and that in any solution it has to come, he has to be part of that. But the issue, and I've said this, look, the Haitians will come to a consensus. They will come to an agreement in the next couple of days. It's just a question of whether it happens on February 2nd or February 6th or the 7th. That is not the problem. The problem is, what do you do about the elections? You know, they used the issue of the violence to say the elections were canceled because of the violence.
Right.
No, the elections were canceled because of the crisis of confidence that triggered the violence. If the United States and others believe that you just put in an interim government and we're going to quickly move to elections, it's not going to happen. So we're going to either fall into a longer transition, or you're going to fall into cancellation of the presidential elections, because those fundamental issues in terms of the fraud allegations, they are still there. The crisis of confidence at the Catholic Church, all of civil society as well as the opposition have pointed out, but yet President Martelly and Jovenel Moïse, his candidate, have refused to acknowledge. So how do we get everybody in the room around the table and say, okay guys, how do we move forward so that we can get a president elected in this country?
The opposition has criticized Martelly for a handpicked successor, have criticized Martelly for the fraudulent elections that they've been able to hold, and then of course the cancellations that have happened subsequent to that. But Kerry Khan with NPR Mexico City, just back from Haiti, let me put the second part of the caller's question, that Haiti and Haitians aren't ready for a democracy, aren't ready for free and open elections.
Well, I don't think you can say that. If you talk to Haitians, this is exactly what they want. They want to do it on their own terms, and they want it done right. I spoke with the U.S. ambassador earlier this week, and he says that there are backroom discussions where they are urging the executive power and the political actors to come to an agreement before Martelly is to step down on February 7th. And I'm glad to hear, Jackie, you're saying that they are going to come to that agreement before the 7th. I'm kind of doubtful It's just if they can't all come together. The OAS has now sent in a team to try and help push the negotiations, and the U.S. Embassy is trying to help. I don't know. Are you confident that there will be an agreement before February 7th?
Yes, there will be an agreement, and I think that this move by President Mateli to call for the OAS is not being well received.
The Organization of American States.
Yeah, the Organization of American States is not being well received in Haiti. I spoke to some people in the business community who are part of these negotiations, and they were not aware of it. And then when they were aware of it, they were not in favor of it. They said this has to be a Haitian-led solution among Haitians. They are not yet at the point where they need the international community to step in and to direct this among them. There are several proposals that are out there, and you've got the Cardinal of the Catholic Church, you've got the business sector, you've got the Senate. They're all involved and they're talking to each other. Right now, I think both sides are buying time, and the danger is that if you allow this the streets to dictate what happens next, then the question becomes what happens by February 7th.
So what are the common points of these discussions? Is there a common calendar? Is there a common process? I mean, what are is the ground here that seems to be seated or at least agreed upon?
Okay, well, let's talk about the sticking points, because that's easier. That's the problem. There's the first issue about February 7th. Does President Martelly leave office by February 7th, or does he stay?
Right.
As Kerry hinted yesterday, he gave a speech in where he hinted about staying past February 7th, although he's made it very clear that he wants to leave on February 7th, but he does not want to leave the country in uncertainty. The second issue is whether or not there will be an interim president or a transitional government headed by a consensus prime minister. The current constitution in play, the amended constitution, does not provide for a transitional government. It provides for an interim president, but you have disagreement. For instance, the Senate does not favor a temporary president while we're trying to elect a new president. I think that point, they will fix that. The questions then become, how do you get to this consensus prime minister? The international community, led by the United Nations, was insistent that the Haitians had to open up their parliament, that had to happen on the 11th. Well, parliamentarians were saying, but wait a minute, we had fraud in our elections too, and the process is not completed. Okay, you want us to do this, we're going to do this. But today, the legislative year still has not opened. You only have one chamber working, and that is the Senate. So the politicians, the lawmakers, have to decide, do we open up the legislative year so that we can select a person to be a consensus prime minister, or do we stay with the current prime minister, Evans Paul? These are all things, but honestly, everybody's just buying time. There's this political game that's going on. Every time they think they have a deal with the president, he adds a little bit more that he wants. Then the other sides add a little bit more. But today, what they have done, the latest proposal, they've removed Jude Celestin and Jovenel Moïse from this accord. So whatever agreement will have to be done by the lawmakers.
And done by February 7th, Tim, and the clock continues to tick away. And the international pressure stepping up?
Well, look, Jackie makes the best point of all, that the real problem here, the real cancer, is just the lack of a reliable electoral infrastructure. You've got a provisional electoral council, as it's called, that no one trusts and is completely incompetent in so many ways. And until that is fixed, we can sit here and talk all day about interim governments and provisional this or that.
Well, the president just resigned a couple hours ago.
Yeah. Voila. as they would say.
Indeed. Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN. Jacqueline Charles covering the Caribbean for our partner, the Miami Herald. And Kerry Kahn covering the Caribbean and Latin America for our partner, National Public Radio, joining us from Mexico City. Thanks so much to all three of you. Still to come on the roundup back home here in South Florida, Broward's 911 dispatch system draws more criticism. That's next. We're back on the Florida Roundup this week on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. It's been almost 2 years now since Broward County consolidated its emergency 911 system, spreading the incoming calls to three different dispatch centers. But calls of criticism continue coming in, criticisms that the system can misdirect 911 calls from cell phones, leading to a delay in receiving help, criticisms and worries that dispatch managers don't always have emergency 911 operational experience. In September last year, a 911 call in Broward went unanswered while a Sunrise call taker ordered lunch.
Happy Tucker Bird delivery.
It's going to be for delivery, please. It's a business. This is Sunrise Police Department.
Okay, what can I get for you?
The lunch order took 8 minutes, and the Sun Sentinel reported the 911 operator making the order received a written reprimand. Have you experienced problems calling 911 in Broward County? Are you a first responder working with the 911 dispatch? Or maybe you're a 911 operator. Join the conversation here. Broward County Emergency Calls up next here on the Florida Roundup. Our phone number, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And Facebook and Twitter, look for us on WLRN. Brittany Wallman covers Broward County for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. And Mike Ryan joins us in studio, the mayor of Sunrise. Your Honor, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Welcome.
Was the consolidating the system a mistake?
No, in fact, you have to look at the history here. What we had before were 10 centers that didn't talk to each other. We didn't have standard metrics. We didn't know what was going on in every center. Everybody had the best center and was perfect. The biggest issue was the misdirected calls, as you pointed out. You could call for help from my neighborhood, and they wouldn't be able to send any help. It would go to the wrong dispatch center. It would have to get all the information, and they'd transfer it, and that creates a delay. We've virtually eliminated that at this point. With the exception of the two centers that are not part of the regional system, they're under 0.5% of those calls because there's no need to transfer.
Two centers for the two municipalities that aren't part of the consolidated system, Plantation and
Coral Springs.
And Coral Springs. Brittany, has the system worked as designed when it was installed in 2014?
I don't think that you can say that it's been a full success. As the mayor says, they have, you know, there's been limited success. Yes, they have cut down on those call transfers that, you know, endangered people's lives. But there's so much frustration among the cities. Cities are now talking about taking back their dispatch because what I think they underestimated how difficult it would be for a dispatcher to suddenly go from taking calls for one city that they're familiar with to a whole bunch of cities. And one address can exist in five different cities in Broward.
Brittany, is this a training a problem? Is it a technological problem? Have you been able to identify? And I'll ask the same question to you, Mr. Mayor. But wherein lies the challenges the system is experiencing here?
I think that from what I'm told, everyone seems to agree it's a training issue. It's a management issue. One of the problems, though, is, you know, the system is owned by Broward County. The county has trouble playing nicely with others. And so there's distrust between the cities and the county, and the county has hired the sheriff's office to run it. And so there's a lot of friction among all the parties about who should pay for the training and was it sufficiently funded and that sort of thing. And so I think it's getting all, messed up in fighting.
Yeah, well, we've got one of those fighters in our corner over here, as a matter of fact, Mayor Ryan of Sunrise. Is that the friction? Is it a training issue, number one? And number two, do you trust the county to run this consolidated 911 system?
I think Brittany touches on really the major points, and let me really break it down a little bit. First, I do think there was not enough emphasis up front on training. I think when you look at these consolidations nationwide, the first year may be dedicated to nothing but training. Instead, the county flipped the switch and wanted this transition to move rapidly. I think the second major issue is that, and Brittany's heard this, there's so much emphasis on moving the calls and time that we're not getting the quality interrogation, the questioning of the calls. And what's happened is the pressure on the dispatchers for these artificial operational metrics is diluting the quality of the information that they're receiving in the field.
You look at the reports from the Fort Lauderdale Police Department. I look at the annual reports from even Miami-Dade County. And one of the significant metrics that they talk about is 911 response time. Every police department has that as a top line metric, a top line measuring stick that they have. And you're saying that's a mistake.
No, I think it's good. You have to focus on time. But what they've done is they put so much emphasis on time that we're diluting the quality of the information. So the major component and what I've been calling for, and I really think what has to happen here, is, as Brittany pointed out, the county itself is running the system. Nobody in the county has the operational experience commensurate with the size of the system to run it. What we need is a dedicated office, a director of public safety communications that reports to the county commission, and take the public safety out of the squabbling that Brittany touches on, that inevitably friction from other issues boils into this. This is not a county city issue. This is public safety. This is the one thing we have to do right.
You've called for this independent director of public safety. But Brittany, let me put it to you. Is this an accountability issue, as Mayor Ryan of Sunrise has identified here?
Well, I think, one question I would have about Mayor Ryan's suggestion is what, you know, it seems to me that that would interject even more politics. If you have a director of public safety now reporting to nine county commissioners, It's a political job. I don't, you know, how does that improve the situation?
Here's how, because right now what you have is the county administrator who, and I don't mean this disparagingly, but we don't need bean counters and bureaucrats and techies running the system. We need somebody with operational public safety experience. That person has to be responsible. In many cities, the police chief may be a charter officer and reports directly to the commission. Mm-hmm. What you do, you have this check and balance. And Brittany touched on this funding issue where maybe the director's saying, I need more funding for training. I need more funding for exercises. And instead, the county administrator may be killing that before it even gets to the commission, saying that's not part of our proposal. We need to take public safety out of parks and recreation and make it a freestanding, independent body that has responsibility and accountability.
Are you willing to shift dollars over to support something like that, not only for the independent creation of this position, but also the presumably the associated administrative support that would come along with it? And the bigger question, Mayor Ryan, is what about the financial resources that your community, Sunrise, is willing to put into a kitty for additional training?
Well, first of all, I don't know that it's going to cost all that much because already you have an Office of Regional Communications and Technology. What you're saying is take all of that staff and move it to an independent office. You presumably have somebody who runs that, and that would be the director. It would offload the responsibility from the county administrator's office. And so I don't see that as a big bureaucratic change, and it shouldn't be. Second, with respect to supporting more training, that's clearly what the cities are asking for. This is a county-run regional system. All of our taxpayers pay for this to happen. And what we want is we want to make sure there's the adequate training, that the public safety metrics are chosen appropriately. Focusing just on time is not what occurs around the country. You focus on time and the quality of information.
Training and policy. Let me ask you, we played a clip from that pizza call, an infamous pizza call. It was posted at the Sun Sentinel website, and the operator told the Sun Sentinel it was practice to make personal calls while logged in as a 911 operator. Is that a policy that needs to change, Mayor Ryan?
Well, first of all, that call and what happened there is reprehensible and unacceptable. And let's be clear, that's not the product of consolidation. This happens in consolidated
systems.
But it
is a product of management, though, potentially.
It's a product of training and individuals, and
right.
It's a human system.
Yeah.
So one of the great things we have out of this system now for the first time is it's transparent reporting. That is a complaint system that we get to see every month. You know how many complaints there are and what discipline happened. That didn't happen before. Oftentimes, you never knew what was going on in these centers. And the suggestion that this didn't occur before is frankly not correct. It may not have been reported. There may have been self-interest in not reporting, but now for the first time, people like Brittany and the Sun Sentinel can look at what types of complaints are coming in, and that's good.
I think that's a good point, but I think, you know, one thing that I'm not hearing here is a lot of focus on Broward Sheriff's Office that's running the system. How did not, you know, it wasn't just this one call taker on a pizza call. There
right.
were four other call takers that were missing in action at that moment, and I did not see any focus on where were the supervisors on the floor and how could this happen?
It's that management question.
Yeah, no, there's no
yes.
question. There's no question. And you know, whether this is a matter of do they have enough folks on the floor, were they paying attention, it's reprehensible at every level, and the floor managers needed to catch this. There's
Are these
no
operators and managers county employees? Are they third-party employees?
Right now, they're BSO. All
they're
of those
BSO,
were they're
right.
BSO. But the thing is that we're seeing, and what I appreciate most is that we're able to identify these, and we need to improve in all areas.
The mayor of Sunrise with us, Mike Ryan, talking about the Broward County Consolidated 911 Emergency Call System, and Brittany Wallman, Broward County reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Thanks to both of you for joining us
Thank
this week
you.
Here
Thank
on the
you.
Florida
Thank you
Roundup.
Very much.
That is our program. We can find us on Facebook and let us know what you thought about today's show and what you're talking about. Facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Our program is produced by Julia Duba and Alicia Zuckerman. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.